Good afternoon, and thank you for standing by. At this time, this conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Ms. Ray, you may begin. And one moment, Ms. Ray.
Certainly.
Ms. Ray, your line is open now. Sorry about that.
Okay.
You may begin.
Welcome, everyone, to the Charm Telecon for March of 2009. We have a wonderful speaker with us today. Dr. Ralph Lorenz will be talking about Titan, one of the largest moons of Saturn, and its spin. And it's a wonderful topic. Just a reminder to everybody that if you press star 6, your phone will mute and unmute. And that's, I guess, all the introduction I have. And with that, I'll turn it over to Dr. Lorenz.
Okay, good morning, good afternoon, wherever it is, wherever you are. I'd like to talk about Titan and its rotation. It's really a story that's really only emerged in the last kind of year or two, and turns out to have all kinds of interesting connections to Titan's interior and to its atmosphere, and even how we map it. I hope the fact that the echo on the telecon disappeared means that you can still hear me. So the first slide is actually nothing particularly spinful. It's just a pretty tiny picture, but it does remind me to acknowledge that I've borrowed a lot of material from many colleagues and unashamedly inserted it here with their permission. So going on to the next slide, slide 2. This just cheekily advertises a couple of books that I've had out in the last few years. Turns out I've been interested in spinning things for other reasons, sort of aerospace vehicles and skipping stones and frisbees and stuff. And if you like, a wide-ranging and not too mathematical description of how those all fit together. There's this spinning flight book. If you can actually see several different aspects of the book in the cover. There's a couple of guys playing frisbee. Obviously, there's a coordinate system of rotating frisbee in there. The sort of spiral pattern is actually the rifling on an artillery gun barrel, and the sort of curvy lissajous kind of figure is actually the path of a golf ball on the inside of a transparent cylinder. If you play golf, you may notice that sometimes very irrationally the ball comes out again. Without actually hitting the bottom. Turns out there's some neat coupling between the rotational and translational motions of a ball. And then, of course, Titan and Bale describes at least the first couple of years of our exploration of Titan with Cassini. So with the commercial break aside, going on to slide 3, I just put this in because it was acquired just 2 or 3 weeks ago, actually. You'll notice that we are getting very close to spring equinox, northern spring equinox on Titan and Saturn, and so the rings are becoming edge on to us. This very nice Hubble Space Telescope picture shows Titan and actually a couple of the other moons on Saturn's disk, so you get a very nice impression of the relative size of Titan and Saturn, and also the relative color. You can see Titan is appreciably redder, darker. You might even be able to make out that the northern hemisphere of Titan seems a little bit darker than the south. But one other thing you might notice, and you can even notice this, I think, looking through a regular telescope, is that even taking into account the fact that Saturn's poles are a little bit darker than the rest, Saturn's disk isn't actually circular. It's actually slightly flattened because it's spinning around so fast. You'll notice the same effect if you play squash, for example, and slice the ball. As it spins really fast, the sort of centrifugal forces, if you want to adopt that sort of mathematical description of a fictitious force, if you like, that the spin will actually flatten the ball, and the same effect is happening on Saturn here. So going on to slide 4, I'd like to actually preface the whole Titan spin discussion with the rather unexpected behavior of the Huygens probe. Probably one of the few things that people take away from the Huygens probe are, the pictures. of course, and the sort of, you know, unveiling of Titan as a place, not just a set of maps or a dot in the sky, but a sort of actual place where something we built went and landed. But it was widely reported at the time that the probe was supposed to spin, and in fact did so in the wrong direction. And there's some very interesting aspects to that story. The apparatus in the picture here is a parachute drop test model, so it's a full-size model of the Huygens probe. In fact, built structurally very, very similarly. It didn't have the same instruments inside. It was built to test the heat shield release sequence and the parachutes and so on when it was dropped from a balloon over northern Sweden in, I think, 1996, from about 40 kilometers up. You may notice in the sort of extreme bottom of the picture, around the bottom of the probe, there are these little wings sticking out, and those were put on to actually cause the probe to spin slowly as it descended under its parachute. There's a rather large, complicated-looking lump of metal just in front of my crotch. That's one of the mechanisms used to attach the probe to the heat shield and in fact, release the heat shield. And it turns out those mechanisms may have been important in the spin. But there you can see roughly what I look like. That was actually a picture taken in Darmstadt in Germany at the European Space Operations Center around the time of the probe descent on Titan in 2005. So going on to the next slide, slide five. This is a scale drawing showing the size of the probe relative to its parachutes. It actually had three. First of all, it was buttoned up inside a little sort of conical heat shield about 3 meters, or 2.7 meters in diameter. And then before, as it slowed down, screaming through the upper atmosphere, this sort of fairly blunt shape would become unstable, and so you fire out a little pilot chute to sort of stabilize it, hold it in the right orientation before it crosses the sound barrier, because the blunt shapes get unstable around the sound barrier. So that little pilot chute holds the vehicle stable while the main chute, while the back cover is pulled off and the main chute is deployed. That main chute lets the heat shield fall safely away, because the main chute is much bigger than the heat shield, which can then fall away because it has more mass unit area than the probe plus chute. But that big chute would actually cause us to take something like 6 or 8 hours to reach the surface, by which time the batteries would have run out and the Cassini relay spacecraft would have flown over the horizon. But we wanted that to happen after we got to the ground. So about 15 minutes after the main chute came out, we actually lock it off with a set of pyrotechnic bolts and fall under a smaller so-called stabilizing chute to let us reach the surface fast enough. So that's the background to what's happening in the sort of vertical dimension. Going on to the next slide, slide six, this is a view of the various bits and pieces attached to the probe. We didn't know if there would be electrostatic charge build-up from charge droplets in the atmosphere, so the little so-called discharging wicks. You can actually see these on the trailing edge of some airliners on the back end of the wing. Airbuses in particular, you can see these little sticks poking out. They form a sharp point that lets charge sort of leak away. There's various sensors attached there, and you can see the antennas on the back and the sort of box-like parachute container. Notice the spin vanes and also these Harzy deployable booms. These are two parts of a scientific experiment meant to measure the properties of the atmosphere during the descent and to detect any emissions from lightning, if lightning were to occur, and we really have very little evidence that it does. These things also measure the electrical conductivity of the atmosphere, and they actually detected a sort of ionization layer caused by a cosmic rays in Titan's atmosphere, where it was predicted. That was a nice validation of a prediction. But the little electrodes on these booms actually have a bit of an area, so they may act somewhat like a wing. You can see the DISA sensor head, that's the camera head, that took all those nice pictures, and it's for that reason that the spin vanes were installed. And you can see more about that in the next slide. Slide 7 just shows the sort of field of view. The camera kind of looks out and down. And going to the next slide, slide 8. So looking at one of those fields of view, looking now at the upper right of this chart, it says HRI coverage, high resolution imager coverage. So this this imager is looking down and slightly out, away from directly beneath the probe. And as the probe spins slowly, that rectangular field of view gets panned around, and so it sort of makes a circle, you know, a circle underneath the probe position. Now while the probe is descending and spinning, it's also drifting eastwards in the wind, and so you have this sort of ever-decreasing spiral of these fields of view as the probe drifts and descends and spins. And there was a certain expectation of how much wind drift there would be, and a certain desire of how fast it spins to take these pictures to make this sort of teardrop. Now, on the left, you can see what the sort of expectations were. There's obviously some uncertainty, that's why there's three or four curves there. What the spin rate was expected to do during the descent. So what happens is at the beginning, at 150 kilometers altitude, the probe was spinning when it was released from Cassini. There's a set of springs actually that pushed it off in a kind of spiral motion to make it spin for stability, so that it would be, you know, pointing nose first when it went into Titan's atmosphere. So it still has some memory of that spin, which is about 6 or 7 revs per minute. Then as the heat shield comes off, those spin vanes start to act. But the probe is falling relatively slowly under that big parachute. And if you imagine the little spin vanes as kind of the blade of a corkscrew, the spin vanes kind of want to make the probe rotate at a sort of fixed number of revolutions per vertical kilometer, so a kind of fixed pitch of a spiral in space. But the probe is fairly massive, and these spin vanes are actually quite small, so they don't change the spin rate instantaneously to that sort of demanded profile. So depending on quite how inclined those spin vanes are, you can choose between these three curves, and the spin rate either slightly increases or slightly decreases. And then we get 15 minutes in to an altitude of about 110 kilometers and switch to that smaller stabilizer parachute. So suddenly we're falling a lot faster, and so these spin vanes want to make the probe spin a lot faster. And so, you know, if they were arbitrarily big, we would jump horizontally on this graph to a new faster spin rate, and then that spin rate would slowly decline as we get deeper in the atmosphere, and so the probe falls more slowly, and so the number of corkscrew revolutions per minute decline. But because the spin vanes have a finite size and the probe is massive, it takes another 20 kilometers or something before the spin rate is kind of spooled up to the new equilibrium. But the main driver for this spin was to pan the images around, but also looking up to measure how the sunlight is scattered by the haze particles in Titan's atmosphere. You'll note when you look in the sky on a cloudy day, there's kind of a big broad patch of illumination around the position of the sun, even if you can't actually see the sun itself, you can see where the sun is. And if there are some particular geometries like small drops of water, you can get halos, and ice particles can cause sun dogs and other kind of atmospheric optic effects, which are in themselves diagnostic of what the little particle in the atmosphere are made of or what their shape is. So the spin was designed with this kind of scientific investigation in mind. But when the pictures came back from Huygens, now jumping to slide 9, I mean, the analogy that Bashar Risk on the DISO team put it to me was like somebody had taken all the images and on cards and thrown them up in the air, and they just kind of come down kind of randomly. They didn't see the sort of expected sequence of images that were kind of randomly chosen. And he began to think that something was funny with the spin. Even just within minutes or an hour of the first images coming back. Now, that doesn't stop you from correlating the images and mosaicing them together, and various people on the discipline and in fact amateurs out on the internet did this very much the same thing. It's kind of like a jigsaw puzzle. While you can get away with doing that kind of mosaicing for making maps, to understand the light scattering measurements looking up, you really need to know what the angle of the sensor and therefore the probe relative to the sun is, and so we needed to build up a spin history, or equivalently an azimuth angle history during the probe descent. So we needed to look at the data. So that's shown in the next slide, slide 10. There were a couple of little accelerometer sensors on the probe, which basically measure the outward fling that the probe slow rotation causes. I mean, you know, 7 RPM is not a particularly fast spin, this is one way of measuring spin on board, because that way that information could be recorded in real time with the camera information. And you know, the expectation was that the probe would be spinning in one direction, because that's the way the spin vanes are set. And so this is an unsigned measurement. And you can see that the spin actually very quickly drops from 7 RPM to very close to zero, and then very quickly jumps up again to quite a fast high value, and then fairly quickly and not quite smoothly falls back down again. So it was vaguely like what we expected, but really a bit weird. There's something not quite right about this. Making sense of that, going to the next slide, slide 11, required some other data that we actually didn't realize was going to be as useful as it turned out to be. As well as receiving the data transmitted on the radio link, Cassini also recorded the strength of the signal. And because of the various bits and pieces on the top of the probe that cause reflections and so on, the signal strength coming from the antennas on the probe depends not just on how high above the probe's horizon Cassini was receiving, but also on the azimuth, the phase of the spin, or the clock angle of the spin, if you like. And you can see that pattern on the right here, the sort of contours of signal strength as a function of angular position in the sky as seen from the probe. So as the probe is sort of horizontal but slowly spins, the Cassini receiving antenna describes a sort of circle on this graph, and there are peaks and valleys. So it's almost like the radiation pattern, the signal strength pattern, is like the petals of a flower. And these petals are kind of pointed towards us, and then not. So the signal strength goes up and down. And in fact, it goes up and down, as you'll see on slide 12, in a very characteristic sort of way, sort of like a heartbeat pattern. And that pattern isn't symmetric. It doesn't look the same going backwards, you know, rotating anti-clockwise, as it does going clockwise. So you can see here early in the mission on the left, 1800 seconds, there's quite a rapid sort of heartbeat. There's a lot of cycles of the same shape curve in that 2 minute period. Whereas later in the mission, 6,000 seconds at lower altitude, the spin is a lot slower. There's only four or three and a half kind of repetitions that occur. So we can measure the spin rate independently of the onboard measurement on the probe, and we can independently measure the direction. And it turns out the direction for most of the descent was in the sense that was opposite from that expected. So going to slide 13, there's a sort of chart of that. The solid curve at the top is more or less what we expected to happen. You can see it's kind of a nice smooth curve. And the real thing started at the same point at the left, at about 7 RPM, but fell very quickly and fell through zero. So really the curves that we saw earlier from the onboard measurements, which were unsigned, were basically just not noticing that the curve was reflected about the zero axis. So that's why it made so little sense. Now, there's a couple of things that are weird about this. One is the fact that it's spinning the wrong way, period. And the best guess right now is that, in fact, these attachment fittings, those big lumps of metal on the side of the probe, were generating enough torque to basically act as wings going in the opposite sense from the from the little spin vanes. And it turns out when we went back to the data from this old 1996 test, actually that spun the wrong way too, and no one noticed. It was much more important at that time to be sure that the parachutes were going to work and that the spin rate was overall correct. But because no one expected it to be the wrong way, no one looked to check, which is an interesting lesson for the future, perhaps. I believe there is sometimes a wind tunnel test planned to check whether the torque generated by these attached fittings could be enough to cause the spin to be reversed. Going on to the next slide, this isn't the full story, though. It's not just that there was this torque in the opposite direction that was nicely proportional to the descent rate. There is something else going on. It may be related to atmospheric turbulence, or it may be something else. This is a colorful plot I made, as you can see from the timestamp, quite some time ago, just a month or so after probe descent. In the sort of upper panel, there's a set of scattered little X's, which are basically the amount of tilt sensed by little fluid sensors in the probe. They're like a little vial of liquid, and the position of the slug of liquid in the vial is measured with a couple of electrodes. These things are used in electronic spirit levels, among other things. And in the lower part of the plot is basically a scatter diagram, color-coded by time, of where the sort of down position is as sensed by the probe. Now, this isn't a true orientation measurement in the sense that purely sideways acceleration can masquerade as a tilt. I mean, if you're holding a glass of beer, you can tilt the glass and the relative orientation of the liquid level and the glass will tell you tilt. But if you suddenly push the beer glass across the table, then the liquid will slosh. So just in that same way, the sensor is responsive to sideways accelerations as well as tilt, so you shouldn't necessarily read the tilt as an absolute angle. But you can see that while most of the data points are, and especially towards the end of the mission when things are nice and quiet, most of the data points are sort of scattered around the center, or at least 0, minus 8. There was apparently an offset in the center reading. Some of the green points, several of the green points, sort of at the left, corresponding to around about 1,000 seconds just after the transition to the smaller parachute, stay well away from that central position. So it's almost like something was holding the probe off at an angle for several minutes. And that's also the time when the spin is doing funny things. And my favorite theory, and not everyone signs up to it, but my favorite theory is that perhaps one of the instrument booms didn't fully latch into place. I mean, it may have come out partially, but didn't fully come out, and that would cause perhaps an unbalanced torque causing the spin rate to change, and also this curious tilt offset. So really the bottom line is that there's something weird going on, or more than one weird thing going on. And that's borne out by the next slide, slide 15. This is a plot from a paper by Eric Karkoschka, who did an awful lot of work to reconstruct the spin history because he was interested in measuring the properties of the haze particles and getting the atmospheric scattering measurement. And so he's plotted the spin history in a maybe unusual sort of way in the sector as the corkscrew angle, the number of revolutions per vertical kilometer. And during a steady state descent under a single parachute, this should be a constant. It should be a flat horizontal line. And you can see that big picture, at least from 80 kilometers down, it's almost a flat kind of line. But there's a lot of short timescale wiggling around it. So whether that's turbulence causing the probe to spin up and spin down a bit, or the lines of the parachute are kind of winding up and winding down, or one of these booms is sort of flapping around, it's not at all clear. We just don't have the information to discriminate between those possibilities. But it definitely shows that the situation was complicated, and we'll maybe never quite know exactly what happened. And finally, now slide 16, there are other things that can happen. When I did some fishing around in the old literature, and you can tell from the attire and the camera equipment, and maybe even the poses here, just this is sort of a 1950s, 1960s kind of picture. This is a vertical wind tunnel. Actually, the air is blowing upwards here of the Mercury capsule, the first U.S. Manned space vehicle. And for some values of the size of the parachute and the length of that line holding the parachute to the vehicle, it would actually kind of cone. It would kind of make a sort of conical spinning motion, which wasn't expected, and it may be possible there was some kind of interaction like that. We just don't know. So maybe I should stop, pause there for any questions, since we'll change topics now and come back to Titan, which is really the central topic of the presentation today. Are there any questions of clarification, or?
Looks good.
Hearing none, I'll move on. So back to Titan. This slide 17 is actually now quite old VIM image. So a multispectral image of pulse colors. The red color in this image is infrared radiation at 5 microns. I forget what the blue is, maybe 2, and blue is something shorter. But this is looking more or less at the anti-Saturn face of Titan, so roughly equatorial and about 180 degrees longitude. You can see a sort of dark H on its side. That's the Fensal Atlan region, Fensal being the upper bar and Atlan being the lower. We believe these dark kind of brownish areas are filled with sand dunes, and those sand dunes have actually been detected with radar and with VIM data. At the extreme left is Xanadu. The Huygens probe landed on entirely the opposite side of Titan, in fact. And just to the at the sort of the 8 o'clock position at the slightly lower center on the left edge, you can see a very, very bright reddish spot. That's Hotei Arcus, which is an area that that may well have some sort of volcanic features on it, maybe even present-day cryovolcanic activity. We don't know for sure. Certainly, you can see in this picture that it's compositionally unusual, that it's got a lot more sort of red brightness to it than most other regions. We've also seen with radar and VIMs that there are morphologies on the surface that look a bit like lava flow. Obviously, when you take an individual image of Titan, you see a given face of it, but if you want to make a map, you need to take into account Titan's rotation. And so the whole mapping business is kind of tied up with knowing the pole and the spin rate. In fact, some of the very first work I did after I got my PhD building part of the Huygens instrumentation was working on some of the first maps of Titan we took with the Hubble Space Telescope, and actually confirming that, you know, big picture at least, Titan rotated synchronously. I'll note on the next slide, slide 18, that's kind of what you expect. Large satellites near their parent planet tend to become tidally locked. That is, they always have the same face pointing towards their primary, that they are in effect rotating once about their own pole per orbit they make around their primary, and that the vector that describes the orbit, the so-called orbit normal, and the spin pole are perfectly aligned, and that the two rotations occur at the same rate. That isn't always instantaneously true, as you'll see on the next slide, in an elliptical orbit, and the Earth's moon does have a slightly elliptical orbit around the Earth, such that because a satellite kind of whips past its primary faster when it's closer to it, so near its periapsis, but it's rotating at a constant rate around its own pole, there's a little bit of a difference between those rates throughout the orbit. I mean, obviously, on averaged over a whole orbit, they come out to be the same, but instantaneously they differ a little bit. So looking from Saturn at Titan or vice versa, you would actually see a little bit of rocking back and forth. So if you stood and the prime meridian is usually defined by the parent body. So if you stand at 0 degrees longitude on Titan's equator, Saturn is basically overhead. But because Titan's orbit around Saturn is slightly elliptical, and you get this difference in the orbital rate and the spin rate, Saturn actually wobbles back and forth in the sky by about 3 degrees. It itself is much bigger than that. I forget whether it's 12 or 6 degrees in diameter. So yeah, much bigger than our moon appears from the Earth. But it would rock back and forth. That the orbital eccentricity and the variation in distance between Saturn and Titan is also responsible for tides, which has all kinds of implications for its interior and possibly liquids on the surface and even tidally forced winds in the atmosphere. But that's a topic of another lecture. Going on to slide 20, we actually can bring in Mr. Cassini, Jean-Dominique Cassini if you're French, or Giovanni Domenico Cassini if you're Italian, same guy, who realized that the Earth's moon actually isn't, doesn't quite have its rotational pole parallel to the orbit normal. There are various gravitational pulls of the sun and there are other planets and so on that cause slight deviations from the sort of perfect arrangement. And once you have this sort of deviation that the spin pole differs, or rather if the orbit is precessing around, then the spin pole will try and precess around with it, by the same mechanism that the spin pole would want to be aligned with the orbit normal. But if the spin pole itself is, if the orbit pole itself is moving, then the spin pole will track around with it, and you get this sort of linear arrangement of one vector kind of tracking around, describing a circle in space, following the other vector around. And this state, which is sort of what you expect after everything has sort of settled down, is called a Cassini state. And I think there are a number of different ones depending on whether N is outside S or N is inside S. But one of the interesting features of this dynamical situation is that, while it's external forces like the pull of the sun and whatever that determine the precession rate, the difference in angle between the spin pole and the orbit pole depends on the internal structure of the satellite, how the mass is arranged, whether all the rocks are concentrated at center and you just have ice outside, or whether it's a kind of uniform rock-ice mixture. You can learn, in principle, figure out some constraints on that mass distribution by just measuring that angle. And I guess I note in a few slides that was realized that Cassini would have the opportunity to do this at Titan. But anyway, slide 21 shows actually the usual way of measuring spin poles and spin rates. Usually you take a picture, or particularly many pictures, because optical images tend to have nice high resolution, so you can identify features in one image and then identify them in another, and by seeing how much they've rotated relative to the viewpoint, you can figure out where the pole is and what the rotation rate is. It's hard to do without an external reference, and fiducial markers like background stars are usually the way to do that. And you can just see some nice star trails here in this Saturn shine image of the night side of Iapetus. There aren't many Cassini images that show the stars quite so prominently. This is a long exposure because it was looking at the night side, and so the stars are nice and prominent. That's kind of the only reason I use that particular pretty picture. The next slide, slide 22, just notes that these so-called optical navigation images are used in Cassini's operations to figure out where Cassini is and to refine the estimates of the satellites themselves. Sort of planetary science trivia, the Voyager spacecraft back in 1979, flying by Jupiter, it was actually one of these OpNav images, just an image looking back to see where Io was in the sky to figure out the position of Io relative to Voyager. And I don't even know if this was more to figure out Io's position or Voyager's, but to measure the position of Io, they, you know, wanted to fit a circle to it. Obviously, if you're fitting a circle, you're getting, in effect, averaging a lot more pixels than if Io were just a single little dot. And this circle didn't fit right. And this engineer, Linda Morabito, when she kind of blew up the contrast on this image, found this sort of, you know, blob on the side. This is the discovery image. This is the first image to be recognized to contain a volcanic plume on Io. And actually, it's tidal heating, the dissipation in the interior from the changing tidal forces, because Io's orbit around Jupiter is eccentric, that the powers these volcanoes. So there's kind of a neat thematic connection there. But coming back to Titan, Titan's actually a kind of horrible object to do optical navigation on, because it's not quite round, and it's got this hazy atmosphere that scatters the light and isn't even the same thickness at all different latitudes. So it's kind of hard to do this spin rate determination optically. I believe it was recognized when the BIMS team at least started to try and mosaic some image data together, that the things didn't quite line up the way they were supposed to, which suggests that maybe with some effort you could do some sort of spin determination with near-infrared data. It's really radar that comes into its own for doing this, because it's not affected by the atmosphere. And the way radar works, you're measuring directly the distance between the spacecraft and the point on Titan's surface, and the Doppler shift between the spacecraft and that point on the surface. So it doesn't depend on a precise angular reference. You don't need background stars to do the navigation. So looking at slide 23, I'll note that somebody on the radio science team that really first got interested in trying to measure the spin pole with radar data. And maybe it's kind of an Italian thing that you have this enthusiasm for the Cassini state, but he realized that if you can measure the spin pole accurately enough, and in principle the radar would be accurate enough to do that, then you could get an independent measurement of the moment of inertia of the planet, of whether Titan has a core, or whether perhaps it's got an ocean and an icy shell. Now they'll be getting some information on that from the gravity field, because if all the mass is concentrated at Titan's center versus uniformly distributed, the very small accelerations that the spacecraft feels as it flies by are different. And the radio science team, I think, has a result that's nearing readiness for publication on that. But independently, you could measure this mass distribution from the Cassini state, from the obliquity, the difference between the spin pole and the orbit pole. So they wanted to make sure that we got some SAR images, and these radar images are kind of made in long, thin strips. They wanted to make sure that we'd get some that overlap, so that we correlate features and thereby determine the pole position. And this was several years before Cassini arrived, and we were in the throes of trying to figure out which 20% or the surface we would get to look at. And it was pretty obvious that whatever we did, because these images are long thin strips, you basically can't avoid getting lots of overlaps. And there are other signs you can do with overlaps anyway. So we said, well, we'll get back to you when we've got a load of data. We're not going to do anything special for this measurement. So it was really kind of on the to-do list, but it really only made sense to look at the problem once we'd had a good few number of these images, such that there were enough overlaps to look at. And that sort of happened by about late 2006, early 2007, once we got a number of flybys near the North Pole on T28, T29, T30. So looking at the next slide, slide 24, while this radar data was slowly building up, there's a very interesting theoretical prediction by a guy called Tetsuo Takano in Germany. He's actually Japanese origin, but lived in Germany for many years. And he was playing with the latest iteration of his global circulation model. So this is one of these big computer models where you kind of divide up the atmosphere into lots of little boxes in latitude, longitude, and height. and you figure out how much sunlight is coming into them and what the pressures are and what the wind should be. I mean, it's the same kind of model that's used to predict weather and climate on the Earth. It turns out it's quite challenging to adapt these models to use on Titan because Titan's atmosphere is so massive, it has a lot of memory. That means that it's quite finicky to model it, and it takes a long time for the atmosphere to spin up to give us the zonal winds that we expected at Titan and were in fact instrumental in that eastward drift of the probe. But he realized that these zonal winds, these east-west winds, would change with the season. And on the left, there's a plot from his GRL paper, which are a kind of slice through the atmosphere. So left to right is going from the South Pole to the North Pole, and up and down is height. And the colors of the contours denote the speed of the wind basically coming into or out of the page, the east-west wind. And blue is in one direction, and yellow is the other. And the five panels of the plot are different seasons on Titan. And you can see that this sort of yellow splodge kind of grows and moves to the north, and then shrinks again, and then grows in the south. And what that means is that basically, you know, one part of the atmosphere is rotating in a different direction from the rest. And the lower you are in the atmosphere, the denser the air is, and so the more momentum is in there. So if you take this cross section at a given season and kind of add up all the amounts of wind and multiply by the air density at the different levels in the atmosphere, you get a measure of the total angular momentum of the atmosphere, just how much the atmosphere is spinning round. And that's shown in the upper right, and it's in kind of kilograms times speed kind of unit, kilograms times speed times a moment arc. And you can see it goes up and down quite a lot. I mean, it goes up and down by almost a factor of six, or equivalently, you know, half of its mean value. And you can see that there's sort of peak around about 1997, and there's a peak around about 1982. So it peaks around about equinox in the Titan seasonal cycle, and it's a minimum near the solstice. The southern summer solstice was in 2002, 2003, and you can see it's at minimum there. Now, angular momentum is a physical property that that can't be doesn't just decay by itself. It has to be either transferred somewhere, that's what has to happen. It has to be transferred somewhere by a torque. Something has to act on it to slow it down or speed it up. So if the atmosphere is spinning up and spinning down, that angular momentum has to go somewhere, and that goes into the surface. And they realized, they're looking at the next slide, slide 25, that because Titan's atmosphere is really quite massive, remember the surface pressure is about the same as the Earth, but Titan's gravity is lower, so the column mass, you know, the mass of gas above your hand standing on Titan, is 10 times higher than the Earth. But, you know, Titan itself is less than half the diameter of the Earth, and it's made of much lighter materials, less dense materials. It's made of ice and rock, not rock and iron. So Titan, relative to its atmosphere, is much less massive. It's much easier for the atmosphere to push it around. And they realized that maybe it's even easier to push around than a solid sphere, because there are models of Titan's interior based on the amount of heat coming out from the rock in the deep interior, that there should actually be an internal water ocean. That maybe there's an ice shell of 50 or 100 kilometers thickness floating on a layer, maybe 200 kilometers thick, of liquid water with ammonia antifreeze in it. And if that was the case, then that shell is a lot easier, because there's just less mass in it. That shell is easy for the atmosphere to push around, whereas if Titan is one big frozen ball of ice, it's a bit harder to move around. And so dividing that atmospheric angular momentum change by the moment of inertia, the effective mass, if you like, of the surface, you get a prediction of how much an observer looking at Titan would see the crust rotate around relative to what you'd expect from a synchronously rotating object. And you can see that for a no ocean case, for a solid icy Titan, there's very little change, and that's what you get in a lot of places. But in the case that you have a deep ocean and therefore just a thin ice shell, the atmosphere can actually push the crust around by 100 kilometers, 200 kilometers. And that was really quite a bold and really quite improbable sounding prediction. I remember really not believing it when Tetsuya presented this first at the AGU meeting in December of 2004. But anyway, if Titan's going to move around by 100 kilometers, we'll see it. So that was kind of set us up for the next step. So looking at slide 26, as we got into the series mapping of Titan, we started to lay down these strips in the areas where we'd seen the same features on different orbits. So here is a feature seen on T25 and T28. Now the radar image here is made on T25 from a bit further away on T25 than it was on T28, and so the image quality is a lot better on the later image, but you can definitely recognize it's the same thing. But when you figure out the Doppler shift and the range to the features, which is how the radar measures their position, and take into account the spacecraft location, which we know from navigating it, where these points should be on a latitude-longitude grid, and you generate the latitude-longitude grid assuming Titan to be rotating about a pole that's parallel to its orbit normal and that it's rotating perfectly synchronously. When you lay these images out, they don't match up. There's an apparent offset by a few kilometers in one direction here, and in some other cases actually even up to 30 kilometers. And it's easy enough to just change the assumption about where the pole is and recompute what the latitude-longitude numbers for a given point on an image are. Select the pole and spin rate that best fits the mismatches. So if you change the assumed pole location and spin rate, then you can make these shifted images fall on top of each other, which they must be because we don't think the mountains are moving around relative to each other. So this is, this is essentially what Bertotti had wanted to do pre-Cassini, and one reason we were doing it was to look for that spin location and assess whether Titan really was in a Cassini state or not. And so the next slide shows the top of the paper in the Astronomical Journal where Brian Stiles on the radar team did this work, and it's a tremendous correlation effort. I mean, there's something like 150-odd tie points that were seen on several different flybys, and by meticulously searching the space of pole location and spin rate and rate of change of those properties, you can get a least square solution that minimizes the position errors. So it's a big kind of mathematics job, and Brian did that really rigorously and got the results that we report here. And he notes that the spin rate wasn't quite synchronous. And I remember when we were discussing the preliminary results, where he said, "Oh, I got to get this pole location," and the pole location sounded interesting, but the best fit spin isn't synchronous. And I thought, that's wrong. That can't be right. But I'd also thought the same about Carnot's result, and then I realized that, maybe it isn't synchronous. Maybe it's not synchronous because of Carnot's prediction. And it's interesting that this spin rate determination thing, this is something astronomers are used to doing. This is very much a kind of astrodynamical, astrophysical sort of question. But winds and modeling the seasonal change in wind speed, that's a whole different branch of science. And yet these two areas of science seem to sort of clash together on Titan. And so looking at the next slide, I kind of just looked into some of the background here, just how absurd is this notion that Tetsuya had about the rotation of Titan changing due to the wind. And in fact, the Earth's length of day changes slightly over the course of a year. because the Earth's winds change. In fact, the distribution of oceans in the northern and southern hemispheres is a big factor here. And so over the course of the year, the Earth's length of day, you know, if you get a telescope and measure precisely when a star crosses a given longitude, you can see that the Earth's length of day changes by about 1 millisecond out of the 86,000 odd seconds. There's a lot of background noise. I wonder if someone can mute their phone. And so the atmospheric angular momentum change is roughly the same, maybe a little bit bigger than Titan. But the Earth is much more massive, and so even though the atmospheric angular momentum changes substantially, there's a big solid planet that's resisting any effects that the atmosphere wants to push on it. Now, the Earth also is slowing down its length of day, or increasing the length of day, it's slowing down its rotation by about 2 milliseconds per century due to tidal despinning. The angular momentum of the Earth's spin is slowly being exported to the Moon, and so the Moon is getting progressively further away. And you can actually look in the fossil record, the geological record, to see things like deposition in sediments according to the tidal cycle that show that, in fact, the Earth's day was only 22 hours long 600 million years in the past, and the Moon would have been correspondingly closer. So, you know, nothing's quite constant. There's a slightly different effect that occurs on Mars, which is very analogous to the sort of skater, figure skater, and this is something that Trina will appreciate. When a spinning figure skater brings their arms close to their body, they're effectively changing their moment of inertia, but they're not changing their angular momentum. And the spin rate is the sort of ratio of the two, so by bringing their arms in closer, they spin up faster. Now, on Mars, what happens is that a substantial part of the mass of the atmosphere, and it's a fairly thin atmosphere, it must be said, but about 30% of the Martian atmosphere freezes out onto the surface as frost, as a CO2 frost. And that happens close to the pole. So some of the mass of the atmosphere is coming from very far from the rotational axis, far from the polar axis, and it's coming to the polar axis, so the moment of inertia of the planet is getting just a little bit smaller as that mass gets drawn into the spin axis and condenses on the pole. And so the planet as a whole spins up again by about a millisecond. So these effects do happen, but because Titan is so small compared to the terrestrial planet, and its atmosphere is so massive, the effects could be correspondingly larger. So, getting on to slide 29, so I basically ran off of the preliminary result from Brian that the apparent rotation of Titan was non-synchronous. I mean, we kind of weren't quite sure what to make of the whole Cassini state story, but at least the first impression was that the spin rate we'd measured wasn't so far wrong from what Tucano had predicted if Titan's interior was partially molten, if there was a water layer. And so we had this paper in Science almost exactly a year ago advertising that, which received quite a lot of interest in the press, because it's in principle quite an important result. And the next slide kind of explains. This is a graph of angular momentum change versus the effective moment of inertia. So if you imagine a Titan that is an icy shell, a few tens of kilometers thick, overlying a layer of water, then the effective moment of inertia of the surface, you know, the stuff we observe with radar, is somewhere on this horizontal axis, and it's small. And only if you have a solid Titan, whether it's got a core or not, that determines whether the moment of inertia factor, MOI, is 0.3 or 0.4, then are you on the extreme right end of the curve. And the radar spin rate that we measured is this sort of gray diagonal line. And we don't know for sure what the angular momentum change would have been, but there was a prediction from Tucano's work, that's that GCM 2005 line. So just taking that and going across and hitting the spin rate, then we see there is no way Titan doesn't have an internal ocean, that it must have a decoupled crust or decoupled shell. And you would have to even take something like two or three times the entire wind profile measured by Huygens, and you know, stop the atmosphere dead or spin it up in the other direction to get anywhere near enough angular momentum for the spin rate we see to be consistent with a Titan that didn't have an internal ocean, that was frozen solid. So it seemed like a pretty robust result that, you know, Titan spin is enough non-synchronous that there has to be an internal ocean. And so the paradigm that emerges next slide 31 is this sort of cross section of sort of brown atmosphere and a little white icy shell, maybe 100, maybe 200 kilometers thick, then maybe 300 kilometers, 200 kilometers thickness of water, liquid water. Then there's some ice, and then probably a rocky interior. And so just by looking at how the features on Titan didn't match up when we mapped them on successive orbits, we kind of got a hint into this deep interior. Now on to the next slide. We did notice that the best fit to the data we had was not only for a slightly non-synchronous spin, but also for a slightly non-synchronous spin that was accelerating away from synchronicity, so that the spin rate was changing with time. And the solid line in this curve is Takano's prediction for that. And you can see that the seasonal cycle goes on, the spin rate comes up and goes down. And we're roughly about the same order of magnitude. Maybe you can interpret this curve as either we're, you know, half as big as the model prediction, but we're going up faster than the model prediction. Or you can even say we're the same as the model prediction, but we're just two years late. And that really doesn't worry me. There's a lot of tunable parameters in these global circulation models. There's a lot of things they don't get right. And in fact, it's radar data that is proving one of the biggest thorns in the side of the modelers, or at least telling us the models have some room for improvement. And that's shown on the next slide, picture of Titan dunes. These are radar images about 200 kilometers across in each case.
Ralph, before you go on to dunes, I guess I had a question that I hadn't tracked recently. Mm-hmm. What about the precession issue with the spin?
That's about four or five slides in.
Oh, geez, should have looked ahead. Okay, problem. I will wait patiently.
We'll get to that. So the dunes are really quite large by terrestrial standards. They're about as big as the biggest ones we find on the Earth. Sometimes when we look with the radar kind of broadside on, you see these sort of glints, these sort of highlights on the edge of the image nearest the radar. Other times we just see the dunes as dark streaks, like on the left, on the right, against a darker background. They're quite striking features. We saw them and didn't quite recognize them on T3 on our second observation with the radar, but on T8, the fourth observation, they were, in fact, T8 is the image on the left here, they were kind of blindingly obvious what they were. Some very nice analogs are on the next slide, slide 34. This is a handheld digital camera image taken out of the window of the space shuttle of Namibia. The Namib Sand Sea has dunes that are exactly the same size and exactly the same spacing and the same sort of length as the dunes we see on Titan. Now, the sand on Titan is different stuff. Almost certainly organic material rather than silicate sand. The gravity is different on Titan, the atmospheric density is different on Titan, and yet somehow we get the same morphology resulting on the surface. There's actually a nice little poem here written by Story Musgrave. I think he saw these dunes from the space station rather than the space shuttle, but he makes this kind of nice juxtaposition of waves of sand and dunes of water. I mean, in some ways, the morphologies are kind of appealingly similar. But as you'll see on the next slide, slide 35, one can demonstrate experimentally that the dunes are not the same as waves. You can't surf on them. Person there is Jenny Radibor at Brigham Young University, who's mapped out a lot of these dunes on Titan. In fact, she's clicked on, guess, 32,000 points on Cassini radar images to measure the locations and orientations of various dune segments. So this kind of dune, this so-called longitudinal dune, forms in a regime where you have wind in two dominant directions, separated by, say, 120 degrees. And the dunes kind of line up along the mean wind direction. If the wind blows a constant direction, just one direction all the time, then the dunes actually line up at right angles to the wind. They form transverse dunes. But where you have this sort of convergent winds 120 degrees apart, they line up along the dune transport direction. But just looking at an individual dune, you couldn't really tell whether that is to the left or to the right. But when you look, as in the center of this image here, at the interaction of the dunes with topography, you get some clues that, in fact, the wind here is going from the left to the right, from the west to the east, because there's this little sort of teardrop tail in the wake of the little mountain there. And so taking that information together, looking at the next slide, you can now see that we're starting to get pretty much to the cutting edge of modern planetary science. This is from a paper that was published 5 weeks ago. But we reported a map of the dunes that have been mapped throughout the Cassini Prime mission through T-44 summer of last year. And you can see there's some interesting regional deviations. To a first order, all the dunes suggest the near-surface winds have a net sand transport from left to right, from west to east. And that, as is reported on the next slide, slide 37, is really quite a surprise, because all the global circulation models want the dunes to go the other way, go from right to left. At least at low latitudes and near the surface, and it's not even a particular feature of any one model. I mean, this is a generic property. In fact, it even follows from just simplistic considerations of the angular momentum balance of the atmosphere, that to make the upper atmosphere spin up, you need some sort of drag on the surface that goes in the direction opposite to that we see in the dunes. And you can see even a quote from or a partial quote from one of the modelers saying, well, did these guys really map the dunes properly? And we're pretty sure we do. There are no shortage of indicators. You can look at any individual little radar image and say, argue about one hill versus another, but when you look at them all and see their context relative to other wind streaks seen in other data sets, it's really quite compelling that everything looks like it goes from left to right. Now, it may be that there are topographic effects that we just don't understand topography well enough, but it may be that, if there are more mountains at high latitude than at low latitude, then that can somehow balance the torques out. In a way, this is just kind of fun. This is the great tragedy of science, a beautiful theory destroyed by an ugly fact. This is telling us something we don't yet know about Titan. Some modeler somewhere will find, I'm sure, a way of making the wind go in the direction indicated by the dune. I think that's just a matter of time. So next slide, slide 38. I pointed out the apparent phase lag, if you like, of the changing spin with regard to what was predicted in the Carnot model. And as I mentioned, there's lots of knobs to tune in these models, and one of those knobs is how the methane cycle is treated, how the methane weather that forms clouds and occasionally rain in Titan's atmosphere behaves, and exactly how you do that methane cycle in the model, or for that matter, how it occurs in reality, affects the seasonal cycle of the atmospheric angular momentum. And that's really all that's spotted here, is you've got different curves for different kinds of methane cycles. There's lots of moisture and lots of precipitation, you get a more muted curve of atmospheric angular momentum. And so you can tune the methane cycle in the model and get a changing atmospheric angular momentum that would match the radar data point. So this is a lot of effort to go to fitting one rather dubious data point, but it shows that the theoretical modelers have no bounds to their ingenuity. Maybe more distressingly, on the next slide, slide 39, is that modelers can also point out that maybe the observation can't possibly be right. That's maybe not to say we've made the observation wrong, but maybe interpreted it incorrectly. But they pointed out that even if Titan's icy shell were decoupled mechanically from the massive interior by a water ocean, that there's still a little bit of gravitational anchoring between the shell and the core. Now, that depends on how non-spherical the core is and depends on rigidity and other things, but their basic point is that the torque is quite substantial. And so the shell really should be anchored to the core and shouldn't move around very much, even though there is an ocean there. So that then begs the question of, well, why do we apparently see the shell moving around? And the next slide...
question, Ralph? This is
Brian. Oh, hi. Yeah?
Yeah, my question is, they're talking about how there has to be gravitational coupling between the surface and the core. What time scale does that have to be on, though? If you were seeing some short-term variation in the spin rate due to atmosphere, would that necessarily be invalidated by this result, or could it just be on a shorter time scale than the coupling?
The plot that they actually show here on slide 39 shows the variation over a seasonal time scale, and you can see there's two curves. One is the orientation of the core in relative synchronous space or something, and the other is of the shell. And you can see there's very little difference between them. I guess you can't see that the exponent on the axis is cropped, but basically they're saying it would be way less than a degree or something like that. Now,
and
that's with
the wind effects that Takano was talking about before, or without them?
This is with the wind effect. This is basically saying that the crust doesn't move because the core is holding it in place, even though the wind is dragging on the crust. Hello?
I'm sorry, I have a question too. I want to make sure you were finished.
I'm finished with that question, I think.
Okay. I see that Takano is a co-author
yes.
on this
yes.
paper, and wasn't he the person who initially suggested the decoupling in the first place?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah, we're at the ragged edge. We're at the frontier of science where we don't know what is right and what is wrong.
So he suggested two different things in a matter of a couple of years.
And if you go back into the Titan Dunes literature, you'll find a paper by me in 1995 articulating about three different reasons why Titan wouldn't have sand dunes. And they were all wrong for very interesting reasons. But Titan for sure has them. And there is, the point I sort of make is that for sure there is something complicated and interesting about Titan's spin. Now, whether it is that its spin rate is spinning up and down over the course of the season because of atmospheric torque, or whether it's something else, we don't yet know. But in the interest of full disclosure, I'm just pointing out all the pieces of work. And this is stuff that's 6 months old. This is all coming out in pretty much real time. So the model here, I haven't poked at it to really see whether they are looking at the right values of whatever right means in this sense, right values of ice rigidity, or whether you could have a thicker ice shell than they assumed, and the answers would come out different. I don't know. I haven't really poked at that yet. I think the way forward is really to get more observations, and that's what we're planning to do. Okay, so maybe if I can take us to slide 40. This is a picture by Randy Kurtz, who shows nicely here how the expected precession of Titan's pole actually kind of pushes the apparent longitude of features on the surface around in the direction opposite from the apparent non-synchronous spin. So it might be that we're looking right now at the difference between two big numbers that's actually a rather smaller number. You can see that in the next slide, slide 41, which is from Brian Stiles' paper, which is essentially an error plot. So it's showing that in this sort of blue area in the center of the plot, this is where you get the best fit. This is the minimum in the error space. And the two axes here are the rotation rate, one of which is somewhere on this is synchronous, and most other places are non-synchronous. And the other is the so-called pole RA rate of change. So that's the rate of change of the right ascension, in effect the longitude or the clock angle of Titan's pole. So that's that pole moving around in a cone in space, and the rotation rate is here. So you can get different values of rotation rates that have fairly low error values, and so could be argued to be correct. The different values of spin if you assume different values of pole right ascension rate of change. Now we found a best fit, and that was what was reported in the APJ and science papers. But formally speaking, there are some other values that could be correct. But in any case, the two numbers are very tightly related because they describe basically how a given point appears to move east and west. So going on to the next slide, another Randy Kirk slide, slide 42. This is a plot of time of apparent east longitude or shifted east longitude versus season, and the horizontal bars. The red bar describes the radar observations that have been analyzed to date through T30 in the Science and J papers. And we are right now coming up very soon on El Silvestre 360, spring equinox, the formal start of the Saturn year. So we're in the latter part of the equinox mission, the little orange bar. And with any luck, we'll get to study this for many years to come in the future through solstice, the purple bar. Now the fit, either non-synchronous rotation, which is a delta easting versus time, would be a straight line, plus the apparent rate of change of rotation rate. So that now then becomes a parabola of delta easting versus time, is shown in red. So all the data we had, the sort of minimum description we can provide for that. Is this parabola, and that fits the data points we had. But if you take the Tucano prediction and add in the precession term, then there's a sort of slope to it, and you can see that blue curve is consistent with the red curve for the period that we observed it. But in the coming years, as we move into the solstice mission, it will diverge substantially. So we have, if we get time, we get to work on this through a good part of the Titan season, we should really be able to see whether the spin and precession effects kind of tease apart. Certainly, the parabola that you see right now can't propagate infinitely through time. We know even from HST observations and Voyager observations that Titan wasn't thousands of kilometers off. It's apparently close to synchronous spin. So time will tell is really the sort of bottom line there. Next slide, slide 43. This is bringing us up to results that haven't even been published in the formal literature yet, in the refereed literature. This is a chart from, or a couple of plots from Bruce Bills. He presented this at the Lunar and Planetary Science Conference, which was last week. And he's pointed out that not only is there a precession of Titan's orbit pole around Saturn's pole, but the Saturn pole itself precesses, and so you don't have this nice circle within a circle Cassini state with the two vectors nicely marching around in lockstep in a circle, but you've got a kind of wheels within wheels kind of epicycloid pattern, and it's not obvious, or rather it's obvious that in general, the vectors won't precisely line up. in the kind of classical simple Cassini state, and that actually makes me feel a lot better, because one of the sort of questions in our mind when we did the first spin rate determination was, well, it looks like the spin pole and the orbit pole and the center pole K are in a line, but they're not quite. And so how close is good enough? We weren't quite sure on that, and now it seems that Bruce Bills and Francis Nimmo have really kind of underscored that, you know, actually there can be quite a lot of motion that the general, more complicated Cassini state doesn't require true linearity. And so, you know, the waters are just getting muddier and muddier as the weeks go by here. If we look at the next slide 44, as I mentioned earlier on, the radio science team, by making measurements of Titan's gravity, can in principle estimate whether Titan's mass is concentrated towards the rocky core or uniformly distributed. And you get that from two numbers, the so-called gravitational harmonics, J2 and T22. And one can estimate a moment of inertia, so a mass concentration from that. And you can also estimate the mass concentration from this obliquity, the difference of the spin pole from the classical Cassini state theory. And the problem is, even taking the sort of more complicated Cassini state formalism into account, these two numbers, and the, neither of them has been published in the referee literature yet, these two numbers aren't the same. So do you kind of have a different effective moment of inertia for polar precession than you do for gravity measurements? You know, the Cassini state theory was for a rigid body, not for a gravitationally coupled, possibly irregular core and a tidally distorted shell. There's a lot more theory to be done to make a decent set of quantitative predictions for that kind of system. Happily, there is, I think, more or less universal agreement that there is enough weirdness about the rotation state, whether it's the precession rate or apparent change in spin, that there's no way Titan can be a rigid body. So the basic takeaway conclusion of the science paper that the shell is decoupled from the core by a water layer seems to be right. But this is, as I say, really at the ragged edge where we don't yet know what theory is right, even what observation may be proven to be incorrect. I think it was Francis Crick, the DNA researcher, that famously said, any theory that explains all the facts is bound to be wrong, because some of the facts will be wrong. So there we have it. So slide 45 just brings in the Sears team into all this. They don't do much with regard to Titan's surface. They can measure its surface temperature in one wavelength. So they make a lot of measurements of the atmosphere. And one thing they found recently is that the sort of center of rotation, or at least the center of symmetry of the atmospheric temperature, and by implication the wind, isn't centered on the geographical North Pole. And for this discussion, it doesn't even matter whether you talk about the orbit pole or the rotational pole that we've measured. There's an obliquity of some degrees in terms of where the center of the apparent polar hood is. Now, you know, maybe that's okay, because maybe planets are not nearly as simple as we'd like them to be. And on the next slide, you can see that, you know, the same is true of the Earth's ozone hole, which in dynamical terms is probably very similar to Titan's polar hood. I mean, both are dynamically confined regions of the atmosphere with distinct chemistry that are immersed in a long polar night. On the Earth's case, the chemistry is related to that of ozone and nitrous oxide. In particular, you get what are called polar stratospheric clouds, ice crystals with nitric acid on them, and these catalytically destroy the ozone during the winter months. Now on Titan, the chemistry is altogether different, and it's hydrocarbons and nitriles condensing and being brought down from the stratosphere. But it's associated with the polar winter. It's dynamically confined in a circumpolar vortex. So there's a lot of sort of analogies, at least, between Titan and the Earth. But whether we learn more about Titan by thinking of the Earth as an analog or vice versa, I don't know. But for sure, there's a lot of interesting comparisons to be made. And you can see here that this feature is not necessarily centered on the pole of the Earth. Now, whether I don't know why that is for the Earth. Maybe it's something to do with just the distribution of mass and topography in Antarctica. And maybe the same is true on Titan. We know with the radar instrument there are mountains of the order of a kilometer high dotted around on Titan's surface and in the polar regions. Maybe those can be responsible for causing such an offset. I just don't know, but for sure there's a lot of interesting things to figure out. So I'll slowly wrap up here. This is just a chart of Titan seasons, and we are slowly working our way to the top of the chart here, actually almost back to where, in many ways, the Titan detail story begins back with Voyager 1. And with good luck, NASA may approve the Solstice mission that will take us through to 2017, where we can see a lot of these seasonal effects changing. But just as Titan's orbit around Saturn is eccentric, so Saturn's orbit around the Sun is also eccentric, and the effect there is the same as it is on Mars, and actually to a much lesser extent the Earth. The effect is that southern summer is shorter but hotter than the northern summer, so the seasons are slightly asymmetric. Now, as the Saturn orbit and pole process, that will change, maybe on timescales of tens or hundreds of thousands of years, even million-year timescales of some parameters. But looking at the next slide, one is tempted to draw an analogy between Titan and Mars, that the Martian poles are rather different from each other. The North Pole is much larger and has a lot more water ice in it than the South Pole. I think I've got that the right way around. Now, the Northern Hemisphere is much lower in elevation than the South. So to what extent is the different structure of the two polar caps controlled by the different topography versus the different illumination of the Southern and Northern Poles during their respective summers? On the Earth, these orbital changes that cause change in the amount of summer versus winter insulation are responsible for the ice ages. So-called Milankovitch cycles, I really prefer to call Kroll-Milankovitch. Milankovitch was a Serbian mathematician who did the math much better, dotted the I's and crossed the T's, but it was actually the Scottish geologist and let's call him planetary scientist, James Kroll, who studied a lot of the glacial rocks in Scotland. Was the first, I think, to work out how much heat is transported by the Gulf Stream, how much colder Northern Europe would be if it weren't for the Gulf Stream or if it weren't for the transport of heat in the atmosphere. And he had laid out the astronomical theory of the ice ages quite well. I think Milankovitch just kind of added to it. But that same kind of orbital changes are happening on Titan. And we know from the radar observations and other observations that at present, at least, Titan's north polar lakes are much more widespread than are its south polar lakes. So you have a difference between the poles, in some ways analogous to that on Mars. And it doesn't seem that topography is obviously responsible. It may be in some subtle way, or it may be the porosity of the ground is different in the two hemispheres. We just don't know. But Odeda Aronson at Caltech has advocated the idea that maybe what we're seeing is some effect of the past 100,000 years or whatever of orbital geometry, that because the southern summer has been shorter and more intense for many, many Titan years, that there's actually been a net transport of materials to the north, and that actually the arrangement of the north and south lakes varies with astronomical time. So but there's all kinds of kind of neat connections. I mean, you're really seeing the kind of Earth system science perspective applied to Titan, that the space environment, the astronomical forcing of the spin kind of connects to what we can measure geophysically, the properties of the deep interior, and the rotation state. It's all kind of linked up together. The next slide, slide 49, shows a artist's impression of a Titan lander. One of the most precise ways to measure the spin of a planetary body is to put a lander with a precise radio beacon or transponder on it. And actually that was the best information we have on the Martian spin, certainly at least until a few years ago, with data from Mars Pathfinder. And there have been proposals, they're not going to be followed up on in the immediate future, for a mission to Titan with a lander, perhaps with an orbiter as well, and maybe a balloon, to really look at all these different aspects of Titan, but in particular look at its interior with seismology and through the rotation state. So, last slide, really the takeaway message, both for the Huygens spin and for that of Titan, is nothing is simple. It seems that there's at least more than one weird, unexpected thing happened with the Huygens probe spin. First, that it went spinning the wrong way, and second, that there are short-term changes that just haven't been explained. And as for Titan spin, we frankly don't know what's going on. There was some nice theoretical predictions some initial observations with radar seem to bear those out, but now there are new theories explaining why the old theories should be wrong. And there are other theories explaining why maybe it all makes sense that other terms can explain some of the discrepancies. I think really the main way ahead is to get more data. But this has been kind of a really fun thing to be involved in because it connects the sort of astronomical problem of spin rate determination with the geophysics of the interior and mapping the surface and the meteorology of the changing seasons and the changing zonal winds. So it's really been kind of a clash of disciplines, which has been fun to be in the midst of. And I'd like to acknowledge all my colleagues on the radar team and elsewhere who've shared this adventure. And thank you for your attention.
Well, thank you so much, Ralph. Do we have any questions?
Ralph?
Yeah.
I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
So what is the angular tilt of Titan's axis with respect to the plane of its orbit around Saturn?
It's about a third of a degree.
Okay.
And in fact, bear in mind also that Titan's orbit around Saturn is itself inclined by about a third of a degree relative to the ring plane.
And the other question is that are all the other moons around Saturn also locked so that they present the same face to Saturn?
No, the close ones definitely are, at least as far as has been measured. As you get further out, time it takes to sort of damp down an initial spin state gets longer and longer. I know for sure Hyperion is not tightly locked. It's actually in a chaotic state. I mean, it's quite profoundly non-spherical. I have forgotten whether Iapetus is... Yeah, Iapetus is
tightly
locked.
Yeah, it's tightly locked.
But Iapetus has the weirdness that its shape is sort of rotationally flattened, if you like, a lot like Saturn.
What about Enceladus?
More than you'd expect, but it's almost the implication that Iapetus is showing us a frozen-in shape of a spin state from some time in the deep past, when it was maybe closer to Saturn. Enceladus, I don't know, to be honest. I think there's something appreciably non-spherical about Enceladus, which may indicate some amount of melting in the interior, but I haven't followed the Enceladus story closely, I'm afraid. Sorry.
Thanks.
Do we have any other questions?
I have a question.
Go ahead.
Yes. If there is indeed a deep internal ocean, would there be no rocky material to be found on the surface, or is there a chance for some unusual upwelling?
That's a great question. The way we think satellites in the outer solar system form is that you have your little lump planetesimals, or whatever you want to call them, of rock and ice mixed together. And as they start to collide, the proto-satellite gets bigger and bigger, and its own gravitational field gets larger. And so the subsequent stuff that falls in more energetically. And when you get up to Titan size, the stuff that falls in is falling in with enough energy that the ice should melt and even to some extent vaporize. So the rock that comes in the latter stage of accretion should do so fast enough that the ice melts, and so the rock would sink through the molten ice, the water. And in fact, what you might have maybe 500 million years after Titan formation is your sort of central primordial mix of rock and ice. Then a layer of rock that is sunk through from the more energetic phase, and then a layer of water on top of that, and eventually that water will start freezing at the top, and the ice will grow. But eventually this rock layer above a mixed ice rock layer, because it's unstable in a buoyant sense, that you've got more dense material sitting above less dense material. Eventually that rocky carapace will overturn, will founder into the core. And that's actually been advocated by Jonathan Lanin and others as a mechanism by which you could kind of sequester away some methane, which would be trapped in the ice, away from Titan's atmosphere during the early years of the solar system. And the reason that's of interest is because the nitrogen in Titan's atmosphere seems to be quite strongly fractionated, that it seems that a lot of light nitrogen has escaped from Titan, whereas the carbon in methane hasn't nearly been fractionated so much. So maybe what happened was early in the solar system, there was a lot of solar wind that causes this stripping away of the light nitrogen preferentially, but the methane was hidden away and so wasn't exposed to that. So with that sort of big picture paradigm, you would expect all the rock to have sunk to Titan's deep interior. But there's always going to be a few traces of silicate minerals in comets and whatever, and a few comets will hit Titan. It might be that what we now see as Hyperion is the remnant of a formerly much larger body, maybe one big enough to be spherical. After it broke up, a lot of the fragments, something like 99% of the fragments, would have fallen on Titan. Maybe some of that material is rocky. So you can certainly never say never, but we don't expect to see a lot of silicate material either on the surface of Titan or sitting in the ocean. There should be, at least thermodynamically, a layer several hundred kilometers thick of high pressure phases of ice between the rocky core and the water or water ammonia layer.
Would that also apply to material that was vaporized during entry into the thick atmosphere?
Well, as I say, even today there will be small traces of stuff coming in all the time. Whether that floats down to the surface as decelerated meteorites, or smoke particles that have been vaporized from meteors that subsequently condense and slowly get deposited along with the atmospheric haze. Yes, there's almost certainly some traces there, but there's not likely to be a large bulk of material. And certainly the dielectric properties we measure with the radar instruments from microwave emissivity all support a predominantly organic or perhaps porous icy, but predominantly organic surface composition.
And the last question is, during the early stages of its evolution, how long would a body like that maintain a liquid surface?
That's a great question. I think of one paper that even attempts to consider that problem. Because what you're effectively talking about is the steam atmosphere. If the surface of the water is, if the surface is liquid water, then there's at least 6 millibars worth of water vapor sitting above it. If the water temperature is 20, then it's 20 millibars. Now, how much extra atmosphere you have depends on how quickly ammonia was converted into nitrogen. We don't know quite how that happened and how fast it happened, but we think that from the isotopic evidence, at least, and the noble gas data, that that's how the nitrogen came to Titan, was as ammonia, and then it was subsequently converted. There'll be some amount of methane in the atmosphere, some amount of hydrogen caused by the destruction of methane and ammonia. And ammonia, water, methane, and molecular nitrogen for that matter, all have their own greenhouse opacities. And the rate at which the planet cools, and therefore the ice, you know, the water freezes over, depends on how optically opaque, how strong the greenhouse effect is in this environment in which we have absolutely no information. So I suspect you might be able to get any answer you want. I would guess, you know, it's a sort of millions, tens of millions kind of years kind of number. I don't know enough to say that it couldn't be 100 million. But the paper that looked at it was one mid-90s, and I think Abe, the first author, a Japanese researcher. There hasn't been a lot of work on this question. There hasn't been much work on Titan paleoclimate period, let alone the particularly, you know, energetic and bizarre episode immediately after its formation. I did do a little work in 97 playing with Chris McKay's radiative transfer climate model to see what happens when the sun becomes a red giant. You know, when you just crank up the sunshine, then, you know, the atmosphere puffs up actually quite substantially, and the haze opacity goes up as well as the greenhouse opacity. But eventually, in fact, you do you melt the crust. You could imagine a very habitable Titan-like environment with stronger sunshine, and so for sure, around giant planets and around other stars, there might well be some, you know, warm kind of Titan with an exposed liquid water ocean.
Something to look forward to. Thank you.
And do we have any other questions? Okay, well, with that, we'd like to thank Dr. Lorenz today for a really complete discussion of this fascinating topic. It was really interesting, Ralph. We really appreciate it.
Sure, my pleasure. Thanks, Jim.
The next CHARM telecon will be on the last Tuesday of April, and that will be April 28th. The topic for that telecon will be our spacecraft manager, Julie Webster, will be presenting some material about the spacecraft recently. We've done a thruster swap to some backup thrusters, and some very interesting things have been happening on the spacecraft since she last spoke with us, which was about 2 years ago. She gave a spacecraft tutorial. So we're really looking forward to that, and we'll let everyone go and have a nice month.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye.
On, Trina?
I am, actually, waiting for the operator to come on so we can stop the recording.
Do you know how many people were on?
That's when I'll find out. We usually have somewhere between 20 to 50 people online, but now that they advertise the CHARM telecoms on the front page of the website, we get thousands of downloads.
Wow. Cool. All right, well, I better get back to work.